Welcome, welcome, welcome everybody to the Deconstructor of Fun podcast. I'm your host, Mishka Katkoff, and today my guest is Warren Woodward. It's a very presidential name, Chief Growth Officer of Uptick. Warren, welcome to the podcast.
Hey Mishka, it's so good to be here. I've been listening for years. I love all things DOF, and I noticed you guys, you know, been talking a lot less about Web3 games the last year or so. So I had to force my way in the door to have some sort of discussion about them, fill the gap.
Yeah, and it's for the context. So we're going to talk a little bit more, but it's nearly impossible to come on this podcast and talk about Web3 anymore. Our Web3 resident host, Ethan Levy, has become allergic to Web3, to my knowledge. And all I see the emails, he just rejects everybody and doesn't really do that much podcast anymore as he's deep into his startup. And I've lost my interest. But then you came in and you had a very clear story that you wanted to discuss rather than shill about a company. So it became much more interesting. And so this is more of an update of what's going on in the Web3 world. But before we jump into that, can you a little bit talk about yourself and Uptick? Like, who are you and what is Uptick?
Yeah, so my story in a nutshell, there's been a lot of twists and turns, so I'll try to do the very quick and dirty version. Started as like a film school kid, worked in independent film production, editing, and I was a touring musician, still do a lot of music stuff. But I actually started learning growth marketing stuff just because I had very unemployable skills between music and filmmaking. So it would actually be like in the van on tour, I would do like affiliate marketing, different kind of like mercenary growth marketing stuff, Facebook ads, MySpace ads, date myself. I've always been a lifelong nerd and gamer. My goal was to like get my skill level up enough to do this for games specifically. Before that, I was doing like dating apps and just sort of like whatever opportunities I could get my hands on. So around 2013, I went full-time into the game publishing world and have been doing exclusively growth marketing for games. Started with a division of Wargaming, moving up to Seattle for that, then heading up user acquisition for a company called Blastworks, more in the casual and social casino space. And then most recently, before starting my company, for Nexon, I led their mobile user acquisition team called Nexon M, based out of Emeryville, California. Mm-hmm. So most of my professional life leading the user acquisition divisions for large mobile free-to-play game developers, and had enough of the big corporate life. And then also really hated that as a marketer, we never got any engineering resources and always had to kind of grind things out in spreadsheets. So with a friend of mine, Tom Fang, we co-founded this company, Uptick. In a nutshell, what Uptick does is kind of two halves to it. We have like our growth services team. It's basically a bunch of my favorite growth marketing people and UA creative data that I've worked with that I got on the pirate ship with me. So we come in, do all the work. We're basically like the external growth marketing team for a number of large game publishers. And then we have our own engineering team, which to me was kind of the fantasy of starting this company was like, hey, I really want engineers to build the tools we need to do our job better as growth marketers. And then as the company has matured a bit, we also now license our software, which is different kinds of UA prediction, iOS scan modeling, and forecasting tools. It's basically like a data and insights layer on top of your MMP data to replace needing to do like Looker, Tableau, build custom dashboards and custom data models in-house. So that's Uptick in a nutshell. Should I touch on how I came into Web3 and
stumbled into this hot mess? I mean, you're just running this autonomously. That would have been my natural next question is like, with all of that background, how are you now the Web3 aficionado? Like, you're based in California, right? You look like you're in Oregon.
Well, I'm adjusting. So most of my life has been California, but I just moved to the East Coast. I married a Jersey girl, so she dragged me over here, and I'm now in South Jersey where it's a little bit colder. So
you don't strike me like you would be in South Jersey in any way. I would have said like Portland would have been what I would have chosen. for anybody not watching the video, if you'd see this, you'd be like, oh, Portland. He's in Portland, right? Seattle, maybe.
Yeah, so I guess the question is, I did time in Seattle. That's mm-hmm. in my DNA as well, too. Oh, yeah. So I guess the question is, how did I stumble into the, you know, the hot mess that is Web3?
Yes.
It actually goes, my first foray into it, some people know this bit of like crypto trivia, but the first giant Bitcoin exchange was called Mt. Gox, MTGOX.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually stood for Magic the Gathering Online Exchange, which was how it first got on my radar. I actually first discovered Bitcoin and stuff through the tangential relationship of Magic the Gathering. I've been a lifelong competitive Magic the Gathering player. And there's this weird overlap where like this Magic site turned into this Bitcoin trading thing and then turned into this like huge exchange that it was eventually hacked. And anyway, so that was my first kind of learning about it. And I was like, what? I don't want anything to do with this. Like everything related to this is all feels very scammy. I don't see anything here other than like speculating on number go up. And I really checked out. Like I saw the ICO boom of what was it, like 2016, 2017 mm-hmm. come and go. And again, it just all felt very cash grabby and scammy. And that passed by me as well. And then the next kind of encounter I had with it was when we all got excited about it in this last bull period. But it was through gaming. It was seeing Axie and instantly that clicking with me of, you know, with my favorite games being collectible games and games that have like ownable objects in real life, Magic the Gathering and other similar games. So it was like, yeah, this makes sense. It's a digital version of it. And this is like new Lego pieces that you can use for game design. And it was very fascinating to me. So I went down the rabbit hole playing a ton of those games, lost a lot of money joining new projects that had nothing but ill intent, but also had a lot of fun, learned a lot, tried building some games with friends for fun. And I really fell in love with it. And I still am in love with it, but kind of ashamedly so, because there's a ton of bad actors. Web3 has earned its bad reputation very well in this first era. But around that time, too, as I was personally going deep in these games and spending most of my time playing them, I pitched my company and my co-founder saying like, hey, I think this is going to be quite meaningful. I'd like us to get like ahead of the curve here and work with some of these games before the market's really saturated and they become kind of a default model for gaming. So we made not necessarily a pivot, but an expansion of our business and started creating a lot of educational content around Web3 gaming, signed some very large clients working with Axie Infinity, Polygon Blockchain, Immutable Blockchain, Sui Blockchain, some of our clients there and the games on those platforms. And it's been fun. It's been humbling. It's been embarrassing at times, being tied to the space and some of the actions that take it. But we're still here at the end of the day. And I think, you know, what I hope we can dig into today is just kind of cards on the table. What failed and why? Yeah. Is the Web3 gaming dream dead, or is there a path forward?
Hey game devs, are you tired of dealing with complicated payment processes all over the world? Well, Exola's got your back with Exola PayStation. It has a simple, user-friendly interface that makes it easy for players to pay for your games and in-game content however they want. And because the Exola PayStation user interface is adaptive and accessible on smartphones, tablets, and PCs, your players will have a seamless experience no matter their preferred device. Players can save their favorite payment methods for future purchases, and on mobile, even charge purchases directly to their phone carrier bill. On the back end, you can customize your checkout with game-specific integration options like sidebars and iframes, as well as change colors, fonts, and images to make PayStation look and feel like a natural part of your game. Ready to see Exola's PayStation in action? Visit exola.pro/payments-dof or visit the link in this podcast description. This episode is brought to you by Data AI. Yes, they were called App Annie back in the day, but let's not talk about that. Let's talk about how Data AI is the first company to combine consumer and market data with the power of artificial intelligence. And Data AI does this to unlock unique consumer and market insight to accelerate competitive advantages across all digital channels worldwide. What we here at Deconstructor Fun really like is Data AI's Game IQ tool. It's this fantastic market and competitive intelligence tool for mobile gaming that allows publishers to really get to the feature level of a game without doing the full-on deconstructing first. Using this tool, your team can quickly tie features to performance KPIs, which will help you make difficult roadmap decisions. It's also a great tool to identify hidden growth opportunities as you can analyze games on a scale. As you well know, there are hundreds of thousands of gaming apps in the App Store and thousands of new mobile games released each month. And while we don't want you to stop reading and listening to Deconstructor Fun, the fact is we can't cover it all. With Data AI, and especially their Game IQ tool, you'll be able to efficiently determine what features provide a lift, make roadmap decisions based on accurately modeled expected outcomes, discover how competitors lifted performance through feature releases, benchmark performance against your competitors, focus with confidence on the highest potential genre for a new game release. We here at Deconstructor Fun are huge fans of Data AI, so what are you waiting for? Go to Data AI and try the service for free.
Well, let me touch upon a couple of things. Well, actually one thing, and that's marketing and Web3 games. So I remember when these projects were getting into a phase where they were actually needed to launch and get some traction and some audience and not just the white papers and the roadmaps. They were unable to get users. And I heard, you know, from many companies, they said, you think mobile, getting users for mobile is tough? Try Web3. It's impossible. Like the hoops and loops you have to do and the platforms you're on, it's the user acquisition is impossible. Is that like, how did you solve that at Uptick?
Well, you know how in mobile free to play, everyone basically copies each other?
No, like I've never seen that. What are you talking about?
Like it happens in game design, it happens in marketing, really? Happens in everything else. with icons, everything else. I mean, the same thing happened in Web3, but the problem is there was, in mobile, there's at least been success cases that everyone's following. Mm-hmm. In Web3, there's basically been zero sustainable success cases. Disclosure, like we work with the Axie team, yeah. And have a long-standing relationship with them. But even outside of that, I always give them slack because the first is always going to be the first to fail. But what happened was everyone saw Axie's valuation rise,
yes,
and copied so many things, usually in an even worse way. I mean, almost universally. But these things are still not battle tested. Like these things have to be scaled up and see what breaks. So my point is, in mobile free to play, people usually copy a proven success. Mm-hmm. In Web3 gaming, there is such fervor and such speed to go to market. Everyone was copying each other without valid paths of long-term success. We still have literally zero cases of a sustainable in-game token for a Web3 game where it's held anything near its value, where it's not lost 90% plus. And you know, one of my theses is like the in-game token as a default is just a function of a predatory VC model tied mm-hmm. to this. And I think the end state of Web3 gaming will not have this in-game token as a default. But it's one of the big failures of the 1.0. Anyway, I'm getting a little...
No, actually, that is... So when you talk about in-game token, meaning like, well, we don't have to talk XC Infinity. Well, let's say just Crypto Thieves is the game that I have. And the token of the game, so the currency of the game would be Thief Token. And how... So you said it's a VC predatory model to have the token. What do you mean by that? By the having the gate?
Yeah.
Open.
So
I know what you mean, but I think a lot of listeners are kind of like not getting it. But go ahead, please.
Sure. So just to back up a little bit, I've talked to we work at any given time with a handful of Web3 game teams, but I talk to tons of them. Usually, I just tell them like you're not ready to market this game, put it back in the oven for a few months, and then let's talk. But one thing that was extremely clear, and I think is still the case, unfortunately, is these games literally won't get funded from Web3 Capital if they don't have an in-game token. So I worked with a lot of teams and know a lot of teams that had no plans from like the first principles of their game design. There was no reason they wanted a sellable crypto token in the game. But the VCs that were entertaining funding basically said, hey, it's a non-starter if you don't put a liquid crypto token in your game economy. And the reason for this is very explicit. It's exit capital for the Web3 VCs, quick exit liquidity for these projects. And in almost every case, the bulk of this is dumped before the game ever goes live in a sustainable way. And it's why we see the charts for every three Web3 gaming token look nearly identical. I mean, even compensating for the overall downturn in crypto. It's why it's so magnified. So a lot of these games were doomed from the beginning from an economic standpoint because you had to shoehorn this crypto token into the game to get funding. And then your token prices collapse to the ground, which causes a lot of negative sentiment, often makes future fundraising harder. And a lot of your own capital plans that were based on that token also fall apart. So a lot of these businesses have collapsed at the very feet of the funding mechanism that was supposed to, you know, bring their game to market.
Yeah, and it also makes the, you know, the games collapse because the token, so what the people have earned in that game, becomes worthless. and the way the VCs or and other token holders, founders including, collapse it is they sell it out, sell it off at the moment when they just can, when you know, when the selling window opens up,
right,
and they just liquidate all or most. And after that, it's just like, if that would be a share and your big in shareholders would liquidate, so there would be these shares coming into the market that would significantly drop the price of the share because there's not enough buyers for that share, and hence the price keeps dropping. And that not only collapses the value of the token, but also collapses basically the value of the whole project.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, if we think about the parallel for a traditional game company or any traditional company, these opportunities wouldn't usually exist until there's an IPO of the business, which usually doesn't happen until a product is quite mature or a business is quite mature. But in these cases, the opportunities for selling large amounts of these tokens happen before the full version of the game has even launched in many cases, thereby, you know, kneecapping the future of that business.
Yeah.
So this is not universal to every case, but it's a common theme I saw in almost every failed project, or to put another way, in almost every project, because the bulk of them to date have failed. And this is me speaking as the optimist of Web3, but just speaking candidly to, you know, what failed about 1.0. So I am still optimistic on the future, and I know we'll get to that a little
bit later. All right. So what happened to the big Web3 gaming dream? Like, we were so I got into understanding Web3 and then really educating myself, and that's where, you know, tokenomics, the podcast segment started and so forth. That was in 2021, and the reason for me was probably the same reason as with all the people who were listening and who were getting into reading about Web3, and that was, it was impossible to hear anything else except that. But if you're a startup, as I was a founder at that time, it was impossible to raise, almost impossible to raise, unless you had some kind of a Web3 play in your product or in your service or whatever you were doing. So we had to, just like the Web3 developers had to shoehorn tokens, we had to have a conversation about Web3. And of course, at that point, investors were pushing that you should pivot to Web3. Hindsight, horrible idea, and also hindsight, good that we did not listen to that. But nevertheless, that was the situation, and that's where I kind of got into it. And then 2022, it all stopped, and it didn't stop with one massive torpedo into the hull. You name it, the assets that were, it was a massive, it was a bloodbath. It wasn't just like this service or this exchange collapsed; all the exchanges collapsed. All the games collapsed. Like Axie was the poster child of all of that, collapsed. Just nothing.
They had the big hack at the same time.
They had the hacks, the users left, the everything. And then they pivot, like they went to mobile and this and that. So there was no success cases. And that was kind of like when I just stopped accepting anybody. Still, by the way, if you have Web3 in your title or anywhere, or if you approach me with Web3 email, I'm not replying. I'm clicking on block right away. It's not a conversation starter. And so what happened since then? Because I haven't really followed it further. I was very skeptical. I was curious, but skeptical. I kept an open mind. What I was seeing, as well as the proof, was in the pudding. I don't need to invest any of my time into learning this nonsense. That's how I talk to myself. And so you can leave, you can spare your few brain cells on something else. And that was it.
Yeah, that was a good summary, I think, of that time period and the big beats in transition. I mean, to back up a little bit, you know, you talked about for your studio and the pressure to add Web3 elements to the games. And we saw that across the board. I mean, I feel like I could count on one hand the major developers that did not spin up a web, ahead of Web3 and the Web3
startup
gaming division.
Is different. Startup is even mm-hmm. like what with big developers. Sure. At least they have their franchises, their work. I mean, it's mm-hmm. only, you know, Yubi was one doing that. You know, Tom Clancy stuff, whatever. But with small startups, they got bullied into Web3. Like the VCs, the fervor that the VCs had for Web3 was insane. Like it was. I mean, they felt that this was the gold rush. Like, we got to go in. And so anybody who didn't listen.
It was for a lot of
people. It was. It definitely was. And so anybody who wasn't doing that, because they were in that world day in and day out, was an absolute muppet. And I remember we were in Slush. Slush was here. Let's put it this way. I'm in Helsinki. So it's a big, big like startup conference. Everybody who's anybody in the VC scheme flies here, and the founders. And I would say I talked to a bunch of VCs. It's 80 to 90% of all of our deals are at the moment Web3. That was 2021. Like, that was it. And serious like bullying from many, many startups, many founders that I know pivoted to Web3 only to either pivot out or die. And I'm hard to be bullied, so we didn't.
And compare that to now. I mean, the feedback I get from all of my friends that run game studios is we've had, if they were doing anything with Web3, they need to actively remove it from any presentations, any investor decks, yes, to have a hope for funding. So it's been a complete 180 from the perception world,
yes,
in the VC world.
And so what happened? Like where did we go? Like, you know this better. I dipped out. I don't hear this anymore. What happened to the dream?
Yeah, I mean, I think to sum in one word, greed. Greed at the micro level, greed at the macro level. So, you know, we already talked about the greed at the funding level and that short-sightedness, desire for fast exit liquidity while valuations were high. We saw greed at the developer level. Another reason that Web3 games have such a bad reputation that we have to dig out of this hole is, you know, I think you and I were probably both there for the dawn of the App Store. And, you know, to make the comparison against mobile, if you think about the top charts early in the mobile App Store days, it was like half fart apps is like my recollection. It's like not our best and brightest. And it was a similar kind of rush of low quality products to get both the first investment and first users. So this also brings bad reputation to the space. So that's the greed on the developer level. And then finally, there was a greed on the player level where play was primarily driven by speculation. Developers dangled the carrot of play to earn as the primary incentive. Play this game and make money. Mm-hmm. Quit your job, play this game. And that was true for a period of time, but it was not sustainable. The time clearly shows that model was unsustainable. I think that the concept of play to earn, and you'll hear me probably defend Axie multiple times in this because, again, like they try things before anyone else. They have the resources to, but you know, they tested that thesis. That thesis didn't stand up in the 1.0 way. I think there's variants of earning that aren't based on financial, but earning collectibles that I think we'll dig more into in the future. But yeah, the greed on the player level of the wanting the game to deliver them a ROI for their time comparable to other, you know, to a job or something. Mm. So I think that's my high level of what broke down at each step. And yeah, there's also just straight scammers, rug pullers, fake projects.
How much do you think is attributable to the economy of 2021 or 2020, 2021 and early 2022, because I mean, look at the stock prices. It was nuts. Everything was going up. There was nothing was going down.
The metaverse dream was real.
The metaverse dream was, well, that was tied to, again, free money. And the belief that what you're doing right now, where you are right now, is what's going to be forever. So we've entered this work from home world, and now everybody's just going to be, there's no more offices, and everybody's going to be in the cyberspace. Anyways, that was then, now is now. But do you think that element was there as well? Because I remember I think it was 2020, it was like the first year, COVID year. And I remember some people were sharing this on Deconstructor Fund Slack channel that this NFT thing is a thing. And like there's rich Asian bankers, because, you know, they're like ahead of the curve, and all these people, like, you know, they're investing in digital art, and it's like a non-fungible token. This is the future. And I was like, This is just people having too much money and just creating collectibles, because the collectible is the only thing that essentially, you know, holds value and increases in value, and is a good park when there's a surplus of money. So how, in short, like how much do you think is this? It was influenced by this crazy money printing the environment.
Macro conditions.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it was part of the perfect storm, right? Both from the ability to create businesses in the sector and get funding from them, and the layer of COVID on top of that, us all being stuck at home. I will say, like, I felt like the metaverse was very real in that time, because I was, you know, to me, like, that's a side tangent, but I was making a lot of new friends in like Discord communities and things like that, and spending more time in like, you know, digital conversations and digital hangout rooms of different types. And there's elements of that that have carried over to now, but it definitely felt like, I think, as you said, like it felt like a new era was starting, but I think we lost sight of, we just overstepped our bounds, like in multiple ways. Like the metaverse as a concept was not there for prime time. It was more like a band-aid to get us through being stuck at home.
Yeah.
I don't think the fervor couldn't have been as gnarly as it was without the funding conditions and the money printer of that time.
Yeah, you should and I encourage everybody to, if you want like comedy, is just to read or listen to the old metaverse talks from like top CEOs. It's such a level of dadaism that is just like, it's mind-boggling. Like it's a bunch of words strung together, and it just doesn't make any sense. Like some people were able to even pull it up in a whole book forms, but I'm so happy that we're over that period. And though I don't know if this period is any better, like
I feel like we're like getting to the great like we're getting in the burn the sage period. Yeah. Clear out the bad juju.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a lot of the ill actors have been discovered and forced out of the ecosystem. The traditional gaming companies that were quickly pivoted up and spun up those divisions, if they didn't have sincere interest in like what Web3 tech can contribute to game design, they're out. Those divisions are all canceled.
Zynga released their game, the Web3 game.
They did.
It was when they released, people were like, "What? Like, what are you doing? Like, this is yesteryear stuff. Like, we don't even talk about this anymore." And you actually released a game. I don't know if they released. Did they release it? I kind of vaguely remember that they released a video or something.
I don't think it's fully. I think it was the announcement.
Oh my god! Yeah. Like that's even worse. Then just put the game out and just stop.
So, I mean, do we want to get into like, you know, what we got right?
Yes. So actually,
like what's actually good
about
this?
Let's talk about two things. Let's talk about the, how was the marketing back then during the bubble times when it didn't work, even though it felt like it worked, but it didn't really scale up. And let's talk about what has changed since then.
I wanted to talk to you about Heroic Labs. Building a successful game is hard enough without worrying about building your own game tech as well. Heroic Labs provides a comprehensive game stack to help you get your game into market faster and scale beyond the competition. With their Unity game framework Hero, you can cut development and prototyping time in half and quickly add social, economy, and reward systems to grow your game. Satori, the LiveOps platform built specifically for the games industry, lets you run live events, A/B tests, deliver dynamic content to players, and always keep your game growing. Nakama, the industry's leading open source game server, lets you develop locally, providing all social and competitive features for your game, and then seamlessly transition to their Heroic Cloud hosted service and easily scale to meet the largest of audience demands. Find out how to get started at heroiclabs.com. The games industry is experiencing unprecedented growth, with global revenues projected to reach a staggering $268 billion by 2025. But with more players than ever connecting across platforms and devices, how can your game stand out against the competition? AppsFlyer has created AppsFlyer for Games to help you unlock your players' true LTV by providing a wealth of game measurement solutions, unique industry insights, and proven best practices. Our dedicated hub is packed with innovative products, industry partnerships, and unrivaled expertise to ensure your game game brand adapts and thrives. We understand that every game is unique, and AppsFlyer's data-driven insights allow us to cater to your specific needs. We know that in today's evolving landscape, staying ahead of the curve is crucial. Trust in AppsFlyer for games to guide you through this exciting journey. We have the tools, the knowledge, and the passion to help you succeed in this ever-expanding landscape. Together, we'll conquer new worlds, both real and fantasy, break records, and create gaming experiences that leave a lasting impact. Get in touch with AppsFlyer for games today and unleash your game's true potential. AppsFlyer for games, supercharging the gaming landscape.
Yeah, I mean, the marketing was also directly related to this fever pitch. It was as simple as, like, create a Twitter account that is a teaser that it's going to be some sort of Web3 gaming project. Mm-hmm. You would literally sometimes within hours have thousands to tens of thousands of followers simply from like someone finding out it exists, posting it in a few groups, that going viral in other Discord and Telegram communities. And a project could have, you know, 10,000, tens of thousands of followers within the first 24 hours. And that would lead to mints where there's fervor over these 10,000 piece collections, sometimes, you know, selling for exorbitant prices. But again, there's greed underpinning all of this. So yeah, we were doing marketing of different types, kind of learning as we go. I will say that's one of the really fun things about this is like, man, I mean, you know how it is, like launching mobile games. I love it, but it's so paint by numbers, so many aspects of it from a user acquisition standpoint, you know? And I love doing that, but it can get a little boring because you know how you're going to execute a soft launch, you know what channels to prioritize, you know how to optimize the campaigns. So it was really cool to kind of go into a Wild West from a marketer standpoint. And it would change like every couple of months. So like during this boom period, you could do a lot of essentially co-promotion with other Web3 gaming communities. You just give people what they call allow list or whitelist spots to mint the collection and say that you have a Web3 game, you have a 10,000 piece collection. You would give, you know, 20 of those spots to, you know, several hundred other like-minded communities. All of them would kind of clamor and enter raffles to get those spots, join your Discord, follow Twitter. And these other projects would essentially co-market your project because it also was a nugget. It was something they could give their own community. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They could say, hey, we've got 10 free spots for this upcoming mint. So that worked really well in the bull market. As things have dried up, that tactic has gotten a lot less effective because now these communities, it's almost, you probably remember like in the mobile free-to-play era, there was this time period where no one wanted to show competitor ads in their game.
Yes,
like block any games of the same genre.
Still.
We're kind of hitting that phase with Web3 where like now people have realized, oh, I don't really want to expose my community to potential competitor communities because it's so small right now. The audience is so small that's still there. So that tactic has really dried up. And yeah, we're using very different tactics today for this early stage. But yeah, micro-influencers are a big thing. A lot of these people that you see like posting on Twitter about Web3 games that they're excited about are, you know, receiving compensation, just like a traditional like Twitch influencer would. That's something that still is, I'd say, is actually more effective than traditional game influencer marketing from the data that I've seen. Because it's more niche targeted to like a very specific audience. Yeah. And then we saw a lot of like failed efforts, the kind of classic big brand stuff, like the Times Square billboard thing that like never works for any game, but like everyone really gets really excited when mm-hmm. it happens.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like ultimately, like what was most effective is engaging like within the niche, like within these other like-minded Web3 gaming communities, finding out ways to do collaborative events like Twitter spaces with the communities that you want to join your community, giving them offerings of some kind. They don't need to be direct financial incentives, but it's just kind of spots on a list.
Mm-hmm.
That works well when things are in demand. It doesn't work as well now.
Yeah, and influencers as well. I remember all the, mm-hmm. you know, the Paul brothers rug pulls. Those right. were infamous, definitely with CoffeeZilla kind of, you know, being exposing them on the regular. Yeah, yeah, he was really on those guys. Plenty of those. But yeah. And what has changed since? Like crypto market?
Yeah, crashed. I guess I should also say, like, you know, what I didn't say, you know, mm-hmm. I built my trade and my company off of doing traditional user acquisition and performance marketing. And I didn't say that because it if you try to do traditional performance marketing for anything Web3, first, most of the ad networks weren't allowing it. But if you could get it through, when it's just a horrible thing to do because it's a niche within a niche. And you couldn't market these games to regular gamers, first and foremost, because the games didn't exist yet. They're more like ideas for games by the speculative thing that might have value when the game maybe eventually exists. So a lot of times teams would hire us because they're like, okay, cool, you guys do UA and paid marketing. And we're like, yes, and we're not going to do any for you because you're going to be wasting all of your money. So that's something that was very true of that time. And kind of on the other side, I know as we look towards the future, like now we are starting to do a lot more user acquisition because the games are more mature. Mm-hmm. They're actually on mobile storefronts. You can actually, your aunt can play them. They don't need to, you know, bridge over to Polygon and create a wallet, et cetera, to have all these experiences. So yeah, paid UA was also off the table.
Yeah. And a lot of startups definitely hired like traditional UA people to run the marketing for them, where I was hearing that, you know, marketing
right. is
basically not working. And the only thing that worked is just, you know, get your crypto enthusiast from whatever place you can find, mm-hmm. have them run Discord, give them some, you know, NFTs and mm-hmm. tokens. And they were just pumping up that community with endless false advertising. And that fever pitch, you know, I've seen the quotes like, we're all going to be rich, let's keep going and so forth. Like,
wag me, bro.
Yeah. Yeah. it's so funny just to like, I remember doing the Tokenomics podcast, where we would always talk about the latest game that was like every 2 weeks. And then Ethan had always bought the latest NFT from the latest project that he was about to start playing. And they were like $500 to buy a character for a tchotchke game that is not even launched or just has like one level. And I was like, and it's not only that, it's just like how difficult it was with like the wallets and this and that. And like there were situations where you're buying and you spent that money, but you don't get the item because it's a mint and whatnot. I was like, this can't be true. Like, this is insanity.
But there's, so I agree with all of that, but there's like a nugget of something like actually really special there. And like, that's kind of the thing that keeps me holding on and that keeps me like advocating for the space in the long run.
Yeah. I just meant like mm-hmm. to play a price of a PlayStation 5 to mm-hmm. a bit character in a game with one level is absurd.
It is absurd. I have paid very embarrassing price for multiple Magic the Gathering cards over the course of my life.
That game exists.
The difference is like that's a game you can actually play. Yeah. That's like arguably the greatest or one of the greatest games ever made with a massive ecosystem around it.
And you can sell that card too because the user base kind of stays.
Right. So we went to that end state without building kind of the infrastructure to facilitate those kind of economies.
Yeah. 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 And like, where are we right now? Like, what has really changed? What makes you feel bullish about this? Like, other than that, there are projects that launched that have removed crypto from their, I don't know what they want to call themselves, 2.5s and mm-hmm. whatnot, but they have a standalone versions without the crypto, so you can enjoy the game. But then you also have the other crypto component, and it's not like the investments have dried out. I think just this week, Sharpnel, the sort of a Web3 AAA shooter game, raised $20 million for Series A.
Very nice looking game.
Yeah. So with they have a lot of I mean, a lot of the investors were clearly crypto investors. In addition to Griffin, that is also, you know, heavily invested into crypto, but not traditionally seen as a crypto investor.
Yeah. So I mean, what's changed? A lot of the bad actors have been burned out of the space. I mean, as we're recording this podcast, Sam Bankman-Fried is finishing up his trial. You know, we saw, the collapse of 3 Arrows Capital, FTX, and everything else that faded mm-hmm. around that time, and that tended to have a bit of a positive domino effect of a lot of the other ill actors were tied to each other. So there's a small fraction of games that kept development through that. And they tended to be the ones with the most belief and most like actual game development resources devoted to them. So, I mean, I'm not bullish that we're going to see a mainstream breakthrough of a Web3 game to the tens of millions. Like, you know, our biggest mobile game that we do all user acquisition for is a game called BitLife right now, which awesome team. I've been working with them for like 4 years, and it's about like 25 to 35 million players a year brought into the game. Like, there's not going to be a Web3 game that crests that scale, even if the sector does everything right in the coming months. But I do think that the game might be in development today. You know, a lot of our games, like by the teams we support, it's about 50-50 Web3 and traditional games. But by user count, probably 98% of the installs and the users are to these traditional games. Everything mm-hmm. Web3 is still a very early stage, helping them go through soft launch, get the data, figure out like what they need to iterate on the product. But the difference is there's games now. There's games. Yes. You can play them. They're fun. You can download them on the app and Play Store. You don't have to like create some weird crypto wallet and, you know, set up an account on exchange, bridge that to another exchange, get rugged in the process. And I think that now that the noise and hype is gone, it's just, we can see like, hey, these are games. These, the way I always describe, at least my idealized take on Web3 is you're a game designer. You're an artist with, paint colors on a palette, and Web3 gives you new paint colors to paint with. It doesn't mean that you use every paint color in every game. It's just like you got these very interesting new colors or Lego pieces that let you do really cool things with game design that weren't facilitated or weren't facilitated as easily before. And it's a much more humble thesis, but I think that kind of comes back to like what pulled me initially into the sector is like, it really gave me ideas as someone who loves games of what you could do with game design in different ways. And that's not nearly as sexy as some of the speculative aspects of it, but I think that's kind of the reality of where I expect it to settle. A lot of games where they're free to play, anyone can start playing them. And then there's this opt-in element for ownable collectibles that can be used in the to build more interesting economies, build more interesting social layers. And so that's what I'm starting to see by the games that have made it through this noise, that have adapted, and that we are able to actually acquire traditional users for while they're in their soft launches.
So back to, you know, basics, if you will.
It's almost like the spaghetti was thrown against the wall, and we figured out like what were the viable parts of this thesis. But there's so much noise and bad actors that I think the sentiment's going to remain pretty negative mm-hmm. for a while still. But yeah, this is part of why I stay dedicated. Like, I think if you remove the bad actors and the noise, which is asking a lot, and can just boil down to the fundamentals. So like, imagine a parallel universe where like the default was games had been built with Web3 tech for a while, and that game economies, you could, you know, trade the game pieces outside of the game, you know, mm-hmm. and that was kind of the default in game design.
Yeah.
If there was a new movement that said, hey, we've got a great idea for game design. You no longer get to do anything with these pieces. They now are stuck in the game and you can't do anything with them. And we're going to remove all of those layers. I think if we like looked at it from that lens, players would be like, hell no. It's kind of a weird thought experiment, but if you kind of boil down the basics of like having ownable objects in a game, mm-hmm. it's a net positive as a game design lever. Like,
yeah.
I gave the analogy of Magic the Gathering before. Like, now I mainly play the digital version of Magic called Magic Arena. You can't trade anything with other players. It when you open up a card you can't use, you're just kind of stuck with it forever. You can't do anything with it, and it really sucks that you can't trade or have it exist outside of that mm-hmm. game, that game client. So yeah, I think that's, you know, that's what I think. If no one would like the inverse of removing these elements, if we were used to them, if that makes sense. I don't know if you agree.
I understand that. My kind of counter to that would be that we don't know what the size of the games and the revenue they would mm-hmm. be making with that technology compared to what they are without it. And so maybe they wouldn't be that successful. Maybe they wouldn't be that big. Maybe there would be more of the niche side. So that wouldn't actually, you know, attract that many investments because the upside is much lower and so forth. So there's that.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we have a lot more physical game examples of those kind of economies than digital game examples. And the money is going to, I think, remain very shy until we get that first breakthrough. So I'm treating the Web3 games we work with as more like, it sounds bad, but almost like the farm league where people are trying ideas more experimental. Mm-hmm. But as far as like a percentage of revenue for our business at Uptick, it's a very tiny percentage. Most of it comes from like these large mobile free-to-play games that we've really scaled profitably. But it's really fun, especially when you work with teams that are like building for the right reasons.
Yeah.
It's just they're needles in the haystack, like from... from the bull period.
You mentioned, you know, bad actors multiple times. And of course there are the blatant bad actors, but what's the, you mentioned that, you know, there's multiple reasons why everything failed. There were the one of the reasons were the greed of the players, but one of the reasons was investors. And how much are they a bad actor with these, you know, crypto funds? And almost everybody had some kind of a crypto play or a specific crypto fund that put money into this frenzy. And when you mentioned, you know, FTX, I mean, the due diligence done on FTX, if you read the reports, was zero. And they just kept pouring money in while the guy was playing League of Legends at the same time, just not giving a damn, not even having a board. And you'd have these so-called top funds putting in hundreds of millions without seemingly any due diligence. I would say that's a bad actor too.
You get no disagreement from me. I mean, like I said, we have a massive hole to climb out of as a space. Nobody really wants to hear about the really good, viable, kind of magical things about these Web3 Lego pieces. When at the tippy top of the stack with the SBFs and some of these funds that were more blatant ill actors. And just to be clear, like, I'm not saying every VC fund is an ill actor. I'm saying like the perverse incentive model was created that then kind of forced failure. But then at the bottom, you know, with individual people on Twitter, you know, flaunting the value of their NFTs, you know, talking about the play to earn as the main driving factor. It's like it kind of like is off-putting at the top, it's off-putting at the bottom. And so it's understandable why so many people drove out of the segment. Okay. And I'm having a really hard time like trying to position the optimism I actually have for the space here, because it feels like a therapy session somewhat, which is good, I think. Like I said, we got to burn the sage, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, how about, and it's not like I do, and I've always had the sentiment. Like I think that the CCP's Eve Online with blockchain technology makes sense. You're mining stuff in the virtual space that you're trading. You're trading in the universe. Yeah. I think this is a technology that can solve a lot of the challenge that you have in your current design.
But yeah, there's also, I think, a really powerful aspirational piece of ownable objects in game. And it's there's a lot of value in having a non-zero tangible for your gameplay time. Mm-hmm. Like even now, part of a lot of my gaming time is spent in competitive gaming with like some esports like hierarchy at the end of it. And it's not because, I mean, I run a company. It's not that that's going to become my primary revenue stream. It's just having that carrot of something that exists outside of me sitting on my couch playing a game and the aspirational layer of it. And I think, you know, that's another thing that Web3 opens up with ownable and collectible objects in the game.
But to some extent. To some extent. Yeah. I've you know, advised also on some other projects. Mm-hmm. And some of these projects had a Web3 component, and they would reward you for certain actions with a token that they had. And they were and still are, you know, with an attempt of creating an economy based on that action that the users take. So not a game. And I just don't find it credible, because when the token price collapsed by 99%, that's not valid. Like if you're getting a fractional of a cent, I don't care where you live, it's not worth it. And especially if you live in in more expensive, we don't call it third world countries and first world countries. What do we call it these days?
Developing nations?
No, we call a new one. There's a global south, which is, okay. You know, South Africa is in south. Is that a global south? Anyways. And then there's what is the opposite of global south?
You got me on this one. Okay. I actually don't know.
They keep changing. Let's use it. First, tier one countries. Let's just get back to marketing terms. Tier one countries. If you're in tier one countries, these fractional cents don't make any fractional of a cent. Is not an incentive. It's almost like disincentive because you actually understand the value of your actions. And you're like, I got this from that. This is ludicrous. This is worse than virtual currency to me. That's how I perceive it. And then Philippines, if it's a fraction of a cent, it's still ludicrous.
I fully agree with you because you're again bringing up the speculative aspect, the purely financial speculative aspect, and the token. The token in Web3 gaming may be the original sin. You know, what I think is far more compelling and sustainable is rare game pieces that you quote unquote earn, but by doing something significant, you know. And this is, again, I'm taking my precedent from physical games, you know, in the same way that if you qualify for the Magic: The Gathering Pro Tour, you get these rare cards that you only get for that. And you're excited about them, A, because they're rare, but they're also prized by collectors because they have a gameplay function. And they have a prestige function because of the circumstances and what they were earned. And you get so many more levers to do cool things like that when you can make innumerable pieces of your games as these ownable objects. So I think that's where we'll find the more viable economies, and when we're creating prized objects of some kind, rather than a token whose primary function is buying you a sandwich if you get enough of it to sell.
Yeah. Yeah. I understand. So you said, just one thing before we move forward. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that that apps and games shouldn't have their own token? It's net negative? I think
the default is a fail state for it. It's very possible someone could come up with an economy where it's sustainable. We have zero examples of that so far. And I would recommend, I'm a bit of a hobbyist game designer, but I'm not a professional game designer, but I would recommend that the default state when someone's designing a game is not, where do I put the token? It's just what's going to make the game the most fun, the best design. Can ownable objects be any part to making this better? And if you come to the conclusion that a token helps, great, but it shouldn't be the default state.
Understood. Makes sense. So let's talk about the current stage. So you said that there are, there are these NFL Rivals. Is that one of them? I think that's one of them.
Yeah, I don't think they actually have anything Web3 in the game right now, but it is a Web3 developer. I'm not really close to that project, so I can't speak with too much expertise. But a good example, one of our partners, Immutable, the two games we're working on launching with them, one is bringing a legacy game called Gods Unchained to more mass market, to Epic Store and to mobile, and bring more of a free-to-play audience into that game. Mm-hmm. That game is it's kind of like the OG Web3 Magic: The Gathering. So that one's very near and dear to me. And then they're launching another game called Guild of Guardians, which is a mobile-first RPG auto battler. It follows a lot of mobile free-to-play best practices, but then just again has, and my goal is not to show these games, it's more just to give examples of how the developers that have survived and the products that are coming to market. But both of these are following kind of proven gameplay models, have on-ramps that require no Web3 knowledge, and then have opt-in economies and are available on mainstream platforms. So there's nothing barring the gate saying you must be a Web3 degen to even start participating. And they're fun if you enjoy those genres of games.
How do you do that? When you have the game, but then there's also the web chain, Web3 component. How does that work? If we're talking about collectible game, let's say Gods Unchained. Gods Unchained is if I remember correctly, there it looks like a little bit like a TFT. Team fight tactics, but it's not. It's
much more like a Hearthstone or Magic: The Gathering arena. It's a card, collectible card battling game.
Okay, yep. Got it. So
Go ahead. To take their model, and again, there's a ton of novelty here. Different teams are going to play with this different ways. So in some games, it's that the only way that you get an NFT is by, you know, earning it through gameplay, not through buying it. For Gods Unchained, they have a rather novel mechanism where you can earn basically any card through gameplay, through free to play. But you need to collect certain components in order to mint the card on chain and make it a collectible, a tradable object outside of the game. So you get a basic gameplay functionality without needing to ever... There can be complete parity in gameplay functionality without ever needing to enter the Web3 space. But then if you want to like mint it as a rare collectible and sell it on the open market, you can opt in to choose to participate in the economy that way. And the other side of that is like when I jumped back into the game recently, I wanted to get a competitive deck. And I went to a marketplace. I selected all the cards I wanted in the deck. I did like a one-click transaction, bought the lowest cost from everyone selling those. And I had a competitive deck for like $7, and all from like buying from other players in a third party marketplace that had minted their cards. Just is their specific example, but yeah.
My thinking just goes that the developer is hosed then, if that's all it took you to build your deck compared to, you know, if you have taken a break in Hearthstone, you come back, you want a competitive deck, you better put some dollars to open up a lot of card packs.
Well, I guess it just is that tension of like how much of a holistic experience do you want to give your players in any game economy before they're forced to spend a large amount of money. And I think the best games always have a pay what suits you kind of model. You know, like even in just Magic the Gathering, there's always budget decks that can be competitive. Mm-hmm. But me as a degen for Magic the Gathering, I will go into playing these weird decks where I need more rare or expensive cards just because I want to like kind of taste the rainbow of different experiences. And it's the same thing with Gods Unchained. Like I just searched for what is a competitive deck that I can get that's really cheap right now, that's mostly common cards. Okay, I'll start with this one. Then I get back in the ecosystem. I get beat by another deck that's more interesting or more my play style. And then I research, okay, what do I need to do to add this card to my deck? Okay, yeah, this one's rarer.
But the developer is not making any money when you buy it from other players, right?
They would be making money from a few different ways. So the entry of tournaments in their game, the buying of fresh packs, and then also because for Immutable, they're unique in that they also own their own blockchain and marketplace. Mm-hmm. There's revenue that they make from trades on the blockchain.
Yeah.
So it's similar to like an eBay seller fee.
Yeah. Quite small if the fees are in that amount, like $7 for a pack, for a full
but let's
playing
make deck. Let's make the analogy, like what is the alternative? The alternative is, you know, physical cards, Magic the Gathering. If I sell a card to you, there's no revenue generated. And there's obviously a robust economy of players trading and selling to other players and whole businesses built on that.
Yeah, but I can't get a single Magic the Gathering card if I don't buy a Magic card pack. I mean, I could steal it, but that's illegal. No.
There's whole businesses of third party Magic vendors and player to player marketplaces for Magic the Gathering cards.
Yeah, but I need to buy it. Like that's what I mean. Like in order to get a Magic the Gathering card, somebody actually bought that Magic the Gathering card. It wasn't free to play. So does minting cost you something then, or?
It does. Yeah. And this is getting a little in the weeds, but like for their economy, that's one of the usages of their token is to like mint the card on chain. So you can either earn that gradually through gameplay or purchase it.
Got it.
And again, everyone's kind of experimenting right now. And sorry, they're doing yard work behind me. Is that bleeding in pretty bad right now?
A little bit, but not too bad. I mean, we're towards the end, but So a lot of these cases, a lot of companies that have actually shipped games and they are, you know, somewhat successful. Again, we don't see the numbers, so it's hard to put finger on it. But why are you still like what keeps you positive? What keeps you motivated to stay with this and kind of believe that there's going to be another wave and that second wave is going to be much better.
Yeah, it's really that taste, like that in that boom era, there was enough like really captivating ideas and hooks in game design and gameplay that it was fun, man. It was fun being part of some of those early games, even outside of like the financial numbers of it. It felt like this is something new. This is something novel for game, both as a gamer and for game design. And being part of a small game design team, like a small indie team that's, you know, building in Web3 for fun, it's really fun to build with too. It lets you think of things in game design that increase novelty, give more economic hooks, more benefits for players. And I that's honestly what's keeping me in it. So there's no illusions. Like, no one is making bank off of their Web3 game right now as far as like a sustainable long-term scaling business. I am placing a bet that I may look like a fool a few years from now, but I do believe that there's enough good in this mud that we're crawling out of right now that I don't think it's going to replace traditional gaming. But I do think 5 years from now, we'll look back and it will just be the default that when creating a game, you consider these colors of paint, back to my earlier analogy, without a second thought, the same way that we would, you know, consider something like, you know, cloud gameplay, or, you know, different kind of economic, I'm not an economics layer, but just different things that are the norm, like kind of models for economies and games that we consider today.
Yeah, I think
there won't be the stigma or this hype around it. It'll be more boring, like from a design standpoint.
Exactly. I would agree. Like, I think this is a niche technology, niche product, or niche technology that creates niche products. Some of these niche products can be successful. Like, let's say the Eve Online with the blockchain technology. That's for sure. But it kind of doesn't warrant the hype that it had. Mm-hmm. Nor do I believe you should be waiting for the second coming of the hype. I think that was like the market during that time. The market was absolutely insane with everything. The collectible cards, physical collectible cards, were selling at insane prices. The stock valuation of Unity was over $200 a share. Everything was crazy, and I think kind of like, considering that those crazy times were somewhat normal is, well, crazy. And now we're in the normal where you should have a much more logical and balanced approach to blockchain. Not, you know, like me, just hating on it. No, I'm not hating on it, but just like not being interested and kind of blocking everything, but more balanced. Like, this is a technology. It's a technology for some of the niche. Some of the niche might be successful, but it's not going to be like anything you heard in 21. And 2020 was just a product of that very, very unique period of time.
Yeah. I mean, I would say similar to the dot-com boom, there was tons of empty promises, tons of bad actors. Yes. But at the bottom of that, sorting through the mud, we saw the birth of so many great companies. But by the numbers, it's the minority of the minority, right? And I think we saw just another version of that era that was magnified by the economic conditions, by COVID, by some of the things that we talked about. So I do think that there's like a diamond of hope and something really legitimately awesome that was devoured by all this noise and bad actors and greed. And I look forward to getting on the other side, burning that sage, cleaning the room of SBF and his like, and seeing what this next chapter of Web3 Games holds.
All right. Well, sounds good. Oren, thank you so much for kind of updating me on, well, not me, everybody, all the listeners with these. The Web3 is still a topic that people tune into because it was such a monumental shift in the industry just a year ago, and it was such abruptly cut that I think people are interested in getting an update where we are right now, and is it all dead? What's going to come in, you know, afterwards, etc. So, yeah, I think we agree on many senses. We're not, you know, super bullish about it, and but there will be use cases, and there are some use cases.
There will be some exciting things once we get past all the noise, all the hype, and have this 2.0 era, which I'm very much looking forward to.
All right. Well, thank you, Oren. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Oren, how people can get in contact with you to share their painful Web3 memories or to ask you about questions on how they can grow their Web3 products or normal free-to-play products for that sense as well.
Yeah, if you're a game developer or anyone in the industry looking for more professional help or resources to scale your game, solve some of these gnarly iOS problems, best way is through the website. It's uptic.com, UPPTIC.com. And if you just want to say hi to me personally, probably Twitter is, or X is the best way. I'm Bleed Kale on Twitter. Kale as in the vegetable. The joke is I'm vegan, so if you cut me, I bleed kale. And that's me. You can also find me on LinkedIn, Warren Woodward.
Boom. That's it. Thank you, Warren, so much for joining the podcast. And let's talk again in a year. Let's see where we are right there.
That's going to be really fun. Thanks, Mishka. Really appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Bye-bye, everybody, and thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to the whole episode. If you like this podcast, please do leave a comment and share the episode. If you want to access the Deconstructor of Fun community with hundreds of senior games folk, go to our website and apply to the Slack group. And if you want to get notified of all the new content we have coming out every week, do subscribe to the weekly Deconstructor of Fun newsletter. Finally, do remember, we love you guys and we appreciate you guys. Catch you next time.